May it please the court, counsel. This is an appeal from Judge John Shabazz of the Western District of Wisconsin. The point that I want to zero in on is that the commissioner decision accepts the first 4 points of the sequential process for the fifth step, that being whether there was other work available for Mr. Kunkel. The national economy is the relevant issue of the proceeding. And under step five, when steps 1 through 4 are satisfied, the burden of proof shifts to the commissioner. And the issue then is whether substantial evidence supports the findings of the administrative law judge in these proceedings. The administrative law judge specifically found a residual functional capacity, which is contained in his decision, but that residual functional capacity failed to include one key provision, and that provision involves my client's ability to do fine manipulation. Under the law, and which cites in my brief, there are several Social Security rulings which carry the same weight and substance as the law, at least for Social Security purposes. While they are not per se law, they do carry substantial weight. And what you need to look at in establishing this is that when you're dealing with a solely non-exertional factor, such as Mr. Kunkel has, a visual impairment, a solely non-exertional factor cuts across all categories of work activity, from very heavy to sedentary workplace limitations. And as a result of that, there are limitations on all different categories. So in order to fulfill the obligation, the administrative law judge needs to apply the rulings to each particular type of category. 96-9P specifically addresses sedentary issues. The administrative law judge in his decision found specifically that there was a substantial number of jobs available in the national economy based on sedentary restrictions, when in fact Supreme Court ruling says that an individual if the judge would have included the residual functional capacity to include fine manipulation, would have been precluded as a matter of law under that ruling. I've also included a finding involving light, and of the jobs noted from the administrative decision, there was a substantial number of light jobs as well. For SSR 83-15 indicates that an individual may be a danger, tripping over boxes while walking, and inability to detect approaching objects or persons, difficulty in walking, up and down stairs will indicate a decision maker the occupational base is significantly diminished for light and, in parentheses, medium work as well.
But the point is, if those are the established facts, then those things may follow. But the administrative law judge seems principally to have looked at Mr. Kunkel's testimony, the testimony of his wife, other evidence in the record about what his ability to get around day to day really was, and I think made adverse factual inferences to positions they're taking. Monocular vision is something that does happen to people, and of course you don't have depth perception, and you might stumble because you don't know where the floor is, and so on, but people do get around, and they learn to adjust after a period of time, in fact. And so the administrative law judge listens to what he's really doing, listens to what he thinks he can do, considers all of these doctors who are offering their opinions, and comes to an adverse factual inference. And so we have a standard of review issue there. If we don't have a factual predicate for these rulings, then they don't apply.
Correct. And you've hit a key point. In this particular circumstance, the administrative law judge adopted all of the findings of Dr. Byers, the treating ophthalmologist, except the one that I contend would have resulted in a finding of disability. And there's no basis in the judge's decision anywhere which indicates any point of law, any basis, any factual distinction which says why he excluded that particular piece of information
which
from the RFC.
Which finding are you thinking of?
His ability to have fine manipulation. All other findings unprotected height, dangerous machinery, depth perception, limited to occasional stair climbing, were all facts that were found as part of Dr. Byers' report. The only one of Dr. Byers' report not included is fine motor dexterity, and under 96.9P, that is the key piece of information which would say that that would erode his ability to do sedentary-style work or sedentary-type work.
Isn't the biggest problem with this case the fact that the ALJ didn't articulate with any specificity the reasons for his credibility finding?
That's correct. That's the second point that's a substantial factor. Remember, this administrative law judge had his case remanded at one point by the appeals counsel to redo it, and then promptly, if you compare the two decisions, just regurgitated his first decision, including the 3 points the appeals counsel noted. There's nothing. If you look at page 22 of the transcript, he recites a whole litany of facts that were deduced at the two different hearings that Mr. Kunkel testified to, but nowhere in there, other than a blanket statement, does he say, I find the claimant uncredible. He doesn't make any distinction. There's no logical bridge that draws point A, that he has the ability to shave, with what he's claiming is a complete inability to define manipulation. If the judge would have articulated any basis at all, I would have no business being before this court. But he didn't, and that's the standard by which this court has to overturn the district court and ultimately the commissioner's decision. I'll reserve my remaining time unless there's questions.
Mm-hmm. Certainly, counsel. Ms. Patterson.
Good morning, Your Honor. Mr. Duncan. May it please the court, my name is Daniel Patterson, and I'm here on behalf of Joanne Barnhart, the Commissioner of Social Security. Mr. Conkle in this case has a very serious impairment of his right eye, macular degeneration, which unfortunately for Mr. Conkle is untreatable. The commissioner does not wish to make light of that impairment or to make it any less than what it is. It is a significantly limiting impairment, and the ALJ found thusly. Notwithstanding that, however, the fact remains that Mr. Conkle does not have any other significantly limiting impairments in this case. He has not alleged any such impairments, and none are discovered in the record. He has complete full vision in his left eye, and he has no other significantly limiting physical or mental impairments whatsoever. In light of this very serious visual condition, the ALJ reasonably found that Mr. Conkle had no exertional limitations, that he could perform work across the board exertionally, but that he was unable to perform work that required binocular vision, that he was unable to perform work at all that required any depth perception because of the loss of vision in that one eye, that because of his vision problems, he could not work around hazardous machinery or at unprotected heights, and that because of his problem judging distances when walking upstairs, according to his testimony and the findings of his treating physician, he should not be frequently climbing stairs in his job. The ALJ's RFC finding is supported by substantial evidence in this case, including the objective medical evidence of record, the opinion of the treating optometrist, and Mr. Conkle and his wife's statements about his activities of daily living. Now, with respect to counsel, I believe he has misstated a key fact about the ALJ's decision in his argument here this morning. He has said that the ALJ gave unconditional deference to Dr. Byers' findings, and that is simply not the case. What the ALJ did properly, rather than treat Dr. Byers' opinion as one giant whole, he broke that opinion down into smaller pieces and decided which parts of it were entitled to weight and which parts were not. He reasonably found that since Dr. Byers was an optometrist, and that was his specialty, that he would give great weight to his opinions regarding Mr. Byers' visual limitations. And you see from his RFC that he did accord controlling weight to Dr. Byers' opinions regarding the visual limitations. What the ALJ did not do, however, was to give controlling or even any weight to Dr. Byers' opinions about these manipulative difficulties. Instead, the ALJ properly looked carefully at Dr. Byers' own statements about that opinion. Dr. Byers' opinion on the manipulative difficulties was speculative and equivocal at best, and by his own admission was outside his area of expertise. Dr. Byers made it clear that he was not comfortable and probably not qualified to render an opinion about the manipulative difficulties. We know from the record that there are absolutely no manipulative impairments in this case. There is nothing wrong with Mr. Conkle's hands or arms, the ability to reach and things of that nature, can only be limited to the extent that they are limited by his vision. Now, to the extent that his vision is limited, that was incorporated not only into the RFC, but into the hypothetical question to the vocational expert. The vocational expert only identified jobs that required no monocular vision,
binocular vision,
and no depth perception. Those would necessarily include jobs that would require the depth perception to do very small, particular work. And therefore, the jobs identified take into account the visual limitations as identified, and that RFC and hypothetical question were accurate, and it was reasonable for the ALJ to rely on the VE's opinion on that matter. I won't make too much of this because I think that my colleague covered this very well in our brief. The council does also seem to sort of misunderstand some of our Social Security rules. I want to clarify that Social Security Rule 9619 does not in any way...
It isn't the only one to misunderstand Social Security rules.
You're absolutely right, Your Honor.
I'm reading them myself.
Yes, we all do. Social Security Rule 9619...
I wish they were written in English rather than bureaucraties. That would be the first step.
I will mention that to someone, Your Honor. That's a good idea. 9619, though, by its very title, which is clearly and plainly in English, is only applicable to cases where the person is limited to a reduced range of sedentary work. Clearly, we aren't dealing with that situation here. Mr. Conkle can perform work across the exertional range. Even if we would concede that he had significant manipulative limitations or visual limitations that did erode completely the sedentary job base, we are nonetheless left with a significant number of jobs at the other exertional levels. SSR 8315 similarly does not apply. It regards a combination of exertional and non-exertional limitations, which we also don't have here. And actually, interestingly, SSR 8515, which does apply in this case, because it provides adjudicative guidance in cases where there are solely non-exertional limitations, such as Mr. Conkle has, in fact, actually supports the outcome here.
Ms. Pedersen, I must say, you are doing such a fine job for your client that had I not read these, the briefs and looked at the record, I'd say, wow. But, bottom line, the ALJ stated in the most conclusory fashion possible that he wasn't crediting Dr. Byer's opinion regarding manipulative limitations. And in the same way that he didn't credit Mr. Conkle's testimony. And that just doesn't cut the mustard, does it?
Well, I think with respect to Dr. Byer's opinion, and we've discussed that already at some length, I think it was absolutely clear. I think the bridge that counsel talked about has been built between the ALJ's rejection of some of Dr. Byer's opinions and the evidence in the record has been built by the ALJ. He made it clear that he wasn't accepting that one limitation because the doctor himself said he probably wasn't qualified to make it. It was a tentative, speculative opinion. And as the record does not contain any other evidence other than Mr. Conkle's own statements, which are actually contradictory, regarding the presence of any such manipulative limitation. And as we've already said, even notwithstanding the presence of the additional limitation, it, again, remember, stems from the visual limitation. Without the visual limitation, we have no manipulative problem. So the incorporation of the visual limitation into the hypothetical allowed the VE to only identify jobs that does not require that type of manipulation.
Stephen, would you take a look at Brindisi versus Barnhart, which is, you know, a 2003 decision of this court? The reasons for the credibility finding must be grounded in the evidence and articulated in the determination or decision. It is not sufficient to make a conclusory statement that the individual's allegations have been considered or that the allegations are or are not credible. The determination or decision must contain specific reasons for the finding on credibility, supported by the evidence in the case record, and must be sufficiently specific to make clear to the individual and to any subsequent reviewers the weight the adjudicator gave to the individual's statements and the reasons for that weight. Here, we don't have that kind of articulation with any kind of specificity for the reasons for the credibility finding.
I'm glad that we're turning to the credibility assessment, Your Honor, and I would like to say that, first of all, this case, this ALJ decision, is distinguishable from Brindisi, Barofsky, Stolen Beastie and their progeny in two ways. First of all, this ALJ did not make a single conclusive statement regarding the credibility, as the ALJ did say in Zaraski. The ALJ in this case went through numerous factors in his credibility analysis, not including the activities of daily living, which were quite extensive in this situation. The physician opinions, although they were few, they were in the record, and one of them was the treating optometrist. The objective medical evidence in this case, and those were the important credibility factors in this case. The other way I'd like to distinguish Zaraski and Brindisi and some of those other cases is that this is a very atypical case. Typically before this court, we have cases where someone is suffering what they claim to be disabling intractable pain. People in the cases that you're referring to have back pain, they have neck pain, they have pain in different parts of their body that requires treatment. The reason for credibility analysis is to decide, is this individual sitting here doing everything in his or her power to alleviate this allegedly disabling pain? Are they seeking treatment with regular frequency? Are they using other measures to control the pain, like a TENS unit or hot baths? Are they taking pain medication? And if so, what are the side effects of that medication? These are the credibility factors. But this is an unusual case. Those factors don't apply here. Unfortunately, again, for Mr. Consul, his condition is not treatable. We're not worried about the thoroughness of the treatment history here. We aren't taking any medications, and therefore there are no side effects. We are not looking to see what the nature, duration, and seriousness of his pain complaints are. It's a very different type of case. In this type of case, we have a gentleman with a vision
disability. Sounds like what you're saying is that this credibility finding just played no role in the outcome of the case.
Absolutely not, Your Honor. What I'm saying is that the ALJ correctly considered the relevant credibility factors for this type of case.
If you think it played a role in the outcome...
I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
If you think it played a role in the outcome, you can see more of my colleague's problem.
But what I think, what I'm saying is that the ALJ did assess Mr. Consul's credibility to the extent it was necessary in this type of case. He did not make a conclusive statement. He considered numerous factors, the most important of which, I believe in this case, are the daily activities. And I realize my time is up, but finish answering your question. If you would just look carefully at the daily activities in this case, I think in this type of case, where a lot of the other credibility factors just don't come into play, it was reasonable for the ALJ to put so much
thank
weight.
You, sirs.
Thank you.
Anything further, Mr. Duncan?
The logical bridge of the credibility issue in this case reminds me of I-794 in Milwaukee, which is called Bridge to Nowhere. In this particular circumstance, the administrative law judge's decision on page 22 of the record goes through the facts of the hearing and then proceeds to go into the next step. I find the claimant's subjective complaints and allegations about his limitations and impairment not fully credible, and then makes no further mention of credibility of the claimant going in then to the medical record. Clearly that's a conclusory statement.
Yes, but that's what gave rise to my question to Ms. Patterson. The ALJ says not fully credible and then makes no use whatever of the credibility finding. It appears to be completely irrelevant. I can't see what role it plays.
It plays a role in the fact that throughout his testimony, he is talking specifically about a lack of ability to do fine motor skill.
There's no medical evidence for any limitations on fine motor skills. The problem might be fine manipulation to the extent it requires binocular vision.
Correct.
No fine motor skill problem.
My inarticulateness, Your Honor. Fine manipulation in this particular circumstance. Even though he's capable of shaving, of using a hammer,
right,
he indicates he has difficulty in performing his duties.
This leads to my question, what role it plays, since they're non-exertional impairments. We had a vocational expert, and the vocational expert is told to assume only jobs that do not require binocular vision. So that limitation seems to have been built in, the limitation that your client says he has, seems to be built into the questions of the vocational expert.
That's only to the extent that you believe binocular vision and fine manipulation are congruent.
Yeah, but that's the reason why. If you have physical control of your fingers, you might not be able to manipulate because you have only monocular vision, and that goes into the question. So that's why I don't see why this matters.
But they're not congruent, Your Honor, specifically because if I were to close one eye, I can still pick up and do certain tasks. The other tasks are not going to be readily and necessarily involved. Similarly, with one eye, he's going to be limited, for example, on his ability to type because he's not going to be able to see potentially full range on the keyboard. This is not a situation, Your Honor, where these rules and regulations make a whole lot of sense to me specifically, but, for example, as an attorney, if you...
Thank you, counsel.
All right, thank you.
The case is taken under advisement. The court will be in recess until tomorrow.